This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Back of throws. There's a long pass. It's going to be, I believe, the Giants run the pellet. 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 Bobby Thompson hits into the very back of the left field stand. The Giants run the pellet, and they're going crazy. They're going crazy.
That's Russ Hodges announcing what may be the most famous home run in baseball history. Bobby Thompson's homer was the final play that led to the defeat of the Brooklyn Dodgers in the playoffs and sent the New York Giants to face the Yankees in the Subway Series of 1951. A Subway Series wasn't quite as surprising then as it is today. There were only 16 major league teams, and four of them were in New York. Tonight is game four of the current Subway Series, with the Yankees ahead of the Mets by one game. My guest is baseball historian Jules Tigel. He's the author of a book about Jackie Robinson. His latest book is called Pastime, Baseball as History. He lives in San Francisco, but he grew up in New York and remembers the Subway Series of 1956. I asked him to take us back to the early days of baseball, when the World Series first became popular.
It catches on quite early. The first series is in 1903. Certainly by about 1910, this has become a major feature on the public landscape. And in those days, the way that most people received their information, because this was before radio, is that each town and each city would set up large scoreboards in which crowds of people, hundreds of people, sometimes thousands of people, sometimes in the big cities, tens of thousands of people would gather to watch the game. And what they were watching was a recreation, where on either side of the score, you had a diamond in the middle. On either side of the scoreboard, you had the lineups from one team or the other team. If somebody got a hit, you would see the runner move to first base. They would keep track of balls and strikes. And people really, for people who lived thousands of miles away or hundreds of miles away and had no way of really seeing a baseball game, this was a moment of high drama. And this remained the way most Americans watched the World Series and received the World Series until the 1920s, when radio came into being.
So in the telegraph era, there were actual theatrical reenactments of the game through the telegraph messages that were conveyed about the game as it happened.
That's right. In some theaters, they actually did have people who ran the bases for you, but other they had these very complex magnetic scoreboards where you can sometimes see the players coming to the plate or see the runners running around the base. But the usual thing was much more usual recreation was a very simple, basic recreation of the lineups, the action. And people really would stand there just waiting with bated breath to see what would happen next. And the telegraph allowed them to know instantaneously, as it was happening at the stadium, what was happening wherever they were. And to most people, this was a miraculous experience to actually be at an event that was taking place thousands of miles away.
Have you read any of the telegraph messages from early baseball? Mm. And is there anything you could tell us about what the language was like before we had, you know, baseball announcers and color casters?
The language on the telegrams, I haven't read them, but I know they were very strictly factual. And in fact, the telegraph operator really prided himself on not putting any of himself into it. He was not a fan. He was not trying to embellish the game reports. He was just trying to get the facts straight so that people could receive those facts quickly and accurately. And that's one of the great changes that occurs in the 1920s with radio. When they first began to experiment with radio, for example, in the 1922 World Series, when they hired Grantland Rice to broadcast the game. And Rice really had no idea what to do. He really didn't know what a radio announcer should do, and he was like the telegraph operator. The next year, Graham McNamee, who was a trained opera singer and had just gotten into radio announcing, became the announcer for the World Series. But McNamee, who was an entertainer, who was a performer, understood that on the radio, people wanted to hear description. They wanted to hear more than the facts. They wanted to be caught up into the excitement of the game. They wanted to hear the sound of the crowd. And this is something that he was able to convey just instinctively. He realized that this is what you needed on radio. And in essence, he was inventing modern broadcasting, modern sportscasting, which hadn't existed just a few years earlier.
What can you tell us about the first World Series broadcast on radio in 1922?
It was very tinny. They had very poor lines. It was Very dull in many ways because Rice really was not a very good announcer. On the other hand, people who listened to it thought it was the most exciting thing that they ever heard. I think to capture, one of the things I try to do in my book is to capture different moments when the game changes for people, game changes for the fans. And that's one of the key moments, the notion that fans could actually be in the ballpark, hear what is going on. There's this vicarious sensation of being at the scene, of being part of something. And I think it's hard for us to imagine the excitement that radio generated in the 1920s, the true miracle of radio, that these people were coming into your home and were telling you, were sharing the game with you, and were recreating that experience. Radio in the 1920s was really a groundbreaking technology, and baseball was one of the main vehicles. It was one of the main things that people enjoyed, particularly that World Series. People waited every year for McNamee to come on and deliver the World Series, and they gathered around their radios much in the way we might gather around our televisions, or they would put radio speakers up in the streets and people would gather in groups to enjoy the game. It was a revolutionary undertaking, and baseball really was in the forefront of that radio revolution.
When was the World Series first broadcast on TV?
I believe it was 1947, very quickly after World War II, but it was only broadcast in the New York area. I think it was very fortunate for television that all of those World Series from 47 to 56 were in New York, were Subway Series, with one exception, because in the early days of television, television existed primarily in the big cities. And, for example, out in the West Coast or in a place like Denver, they had no way of broadcasting or telecasting live events up until 1951. So the primary audience in the for the World Series on television was originally in New York, then on the East Coast. So it was quite a good coincidence for early TV that all of those games were played in New York.
What are some of the ways you think that television has changed baseball?
Well, I think, you know, in many ways it's democratized it. It enables us to see far more games. I mean, when people talk about the golden age of baseball in the 1920s, most people never got to see a Major League Baseball game. Most people didn't get to see these Major League players. They began to see them in newsreels in the theaters, which was another major breakthrough at that time. But they never really saw them in person, except maybe in the postseason, players would barnstorm around the nation. Babe Ruth would take an all-star team, and that was a very popular attraction. But, of course, with television, we all can see games. We all can see more games than we ever dreamed of seeing, and probably more games than it's good for us to see in the course of a season. And so I think one of the key contributions is to democratize the game.
Let's go back to very early baseball history, to 1860, when there was a Currier and Ives illustration that had the caption, "The National Game." Describe this illustration for us.
It's a wonderful illustration. It's an illustration about what was, at that time, the most important presidential election in the nation's history, and that was the election where Lincoln came to office. And it shows the four presidential candidates of the time and all of their respective positions, but they're all dressed as baseball players. And Lincoln is for non-extension of slavery, and he's carrying not a bat, but a rail, because he was the rail splitter. And Stephen Douglas is there advocating his position. And they're all talking as if this was not a political election, but a baseball game. They talk about being struck out and hitting a home run. And what's striking to me about this cartoon, and I use this to really start to start pastime, is that here we are in 1860, just really a few years after baseball begins to spread in popularity. It really is in 1855 that the game begins to take off, and it's primarily at that time a New York game. And yet Currier and Ives, which has a national clientele, is very confident that people will understand the baseball imagery, and they also are using the term that's increasingly used to describe baseball, the national game. And, of course, it's also being called the national pastime at that time. So the puzzle is, why did baseball appeal to the people of that era? Here is where baseball suddenly is becoming an integral part of American culture of American society. And that cartoon, I think, captured that that puzzle.
Well, what was baseball like in 1860 at the time of this illustration?
Well, it was not a professional game, although we do have at that time some of the clubs that are organizing the game, clubs like the Knickerbocker Club or the Excelsiors of Brooklyn. Some of these clubs are beginning to sort of pay people under the table or hire people in a certain job, but their real job is to play baseball. So professionalization is creeping in. And many of the rules are the same that we have today. Certainly, you play for balls and strikes, although the numbers of balls and strikes varied from place to place. They played a nine-inning structure, which was different than earlier versions where you might play the first team to get 100 runs. They played games that the pitching was underhand, and the batters could tell a pitcher if they wanted a high pitch or a low pitch or a pitch in the middle. So the game was still evolving, but it's a game that I think we would still recognize in most of its respects.
You credit Henry Chadwick as being, you know, one of the men who actually created modern baseball. And it was during this era that we're talking about in the mid-1800s. You say his goal was to create a national game, so he needed uniform rules, scoring. What are some of the things that he invented?
Well, he invents the box score, which, of course, is integral for our understanding the game. He popularizes the batting average, which is not necessarily a good thing because it's not the best measure of hitting prowess, but Chadwick thought it was, and many people still think that it is. What Chadwick really did, Chadwick was not a player, although he was a good athlete himself, but he was a sports writer. And he recognized that this game was something that Americans could like and would like, but that what we needed was some sort of a uniform scoring structure. We needed a statistical basis for comparison. How can you tell, really, just by watching a game, who is a good player, who is not a good player? You might see somebody hit a home run in one game and think he's terrific, but it turns out that it's the only home run he hit. And so Chadwick emphasized record-keeping, score-keeping, developing ways to measure player productivity. He developed the concept of earned runs and unearned runs, which he saw as a batting statistic. He didn't want players to get credit for doing something good when the real contribution was on the negative defense side. So he believed in something really being accounted on a very highly moral. He lived in a very highly moral universe, very structured by pre-Civil War reform movements. And so he integrated all of this into baseball's statistical universe. And many of the statistics, many of the measures that he developed are still the ones that we use to keep track of players today.
My guest is Jules Tigel. He's the author of Pastime, Baseball as History. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jules Tigel, who has written several books about baseball history. His latest is called Pastime, Baseball as History. You see the 1980s as the start of baseball nostalgia. Do you think we're still in that phase of baseball nostalgia?
To a lesser extent, but I think what of course happened in the 1980s is my generation, the baby boom generation, came of age. And this is, I do believe, this may be the last great baseball generation, in that we were raised at a time when baseball was the central sport in America, where America really saw itself coming of age in baseball. We lived through the Jackie Robinson experience, which was such a formative experience for us as a nation, for us as people. And so baseball really means something to my generation. And as we became old, and there were a lot of us, too, that's the other thing. You know, part of the reason baseball has its popularity is among people, I think, age 45 and over, more so than among a younger generation. And, of course, as we've come of age, there are a lot of us. We have a good amount of money in an affluent society, and we're able to indulge our baseball fantasies. And in the 1980s, we indulged them through rotisserie leagues where we sort of managed our own teams, fantasy camps in which you could go and play with the heroes of your youth. Academics like myself were writing books about baseball, taking it seriously as a scholarly endeavor. The great baseball movies of the 1980s like Bull Durham and Field of Dreams. I think much of this was a generational thing. And, you know, that generation is still there. And so we still have that sense of nostalgia. But I think it's not quite as heated. It's cooled off a bit in the 1990s and in the 21st century from the way that it was in the 1980s.
The Yankees have won two consecutive World Series. If they win this year, it'll be their third. Some people downplay the achievements of the Yankees, saying that, you know, George Steinbrenner has deep pockets. He just goes out and buys the best player. So, of course, they have a good team. What do you think of that?
I think you still have to make the right decisions. Very clearly, there is an economic imbalance in baseball. I'm not sure it's any different than it always has been, because don't forget, in the golden age of baseball that people want to harken back to, the Yankees won the pennant almost every year. And one of the main reasons for that is they had the money to buy the best players, to scout the best players, to have an extensive developmental farm system. So there was an imbalance historically in baseball. The imbalance that's taking place in the 90s may be a momentary thing. After all, this year in the playoffs, you had low payroll teams like Oakland, like Chicago White Sox, like Seattle, who made it into the playoffs. That's true that two of the higher payroll teams have made it to the World Series. But even when you have a high payroll, you can look at a team like the Baltimore Orioles, like the Los Angeles Dodgers, who seem to make all the wrong decisions. So even when you have a lot of money, you have to have good management. You have to choose the right players. You have to nurture those players and make sure they perform on the field. So I think this remains a tremendous achievement to have won three World Series in 4 years. And certainly if they win another one, they can rank there among baseball's great dynasties.
Well, what are some of your memories of the Subway Series in New York when you were a kid?
I really remember that, you know, there's this notion that people talking about that you could walk through the streets and virtually hear every inning. That's sort of my recollection, too. Everybody seemed to be listening on the radio to the games if they were not inside watching them on television. I think that we sort of saw it as a right. I mean, this was not something that was a surprise, that the way it is now, that comes once every four decades. We had it every year, and we expected it every year. At least one team from New York area would be in the World Series. And, of course, in many years, several teams, or both of the teams in the World Series, would be there. So it seemed, you know, I was 7 years old in 1956, and I was already a very big baseball fan and already going to baseball games, though not the World Series. And it just seemed something like I expected to happen. And I could have never envisioned that within a couple of years, not only wouldn't there be a Subway Series, but there would only be the Dodgers, the Giants would have fled to California. And that era really had come to an end.
You wrote a book about Jackie Robinson. And in writing about Robinson, you wrote about race and baseball. How do you see race as coming into play now in the game?
There's a much more complex racial configuration of the game, because we now have so many more Latino players coming from such a wide range of countries in the Caribbean. And many teams can have players from five, six, seven countries in the Western Hemisphere that have to mix and come together. And, of course, there's also been an influx now of Asian players, particularly Japanese, but also Korean players, and then players from Australia. In many ways, this is a much more international game. And I think that like American society, again, this is reflective of the fact that we used to think of race in terms of black and white. But we live in a much more multicultural society. Baseball is a much more multicultural game. And I think this has added to the allure of baseball. I think certainly the quality of the players being able to tap into that richer international pool has improved the game. But it also, in many ways, like that when Jackie Robinson, of course, made people think about race relations, I think the international nature of the game makes people think more about the nature of the multicultural society we live in. So once again, baseball has the potential to be a humanizing, to be a democratizing force in American life.
Jules Tigel is the author of Pastime, Baseball as History. He's a professor of history at San Francisco State University. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the complete short stories of Evelyn Waugh. This is Fresh Air.